You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jō toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Waiwharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whai akane, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government's job seeker support changes for 18 to 19-year-olds and the government's amendments to the Policing Act. Following my chat from Simon, I spoke more about the amendments to the Policing Act with Gahan Gunasekara, the convener of the surveillance group within the Privacy Foundation and an associate commercial law professor at the University of Auckland, about concerns these changes will create a surveillance state. And on Thursday, 95BFM intern Zane Noor spoke to Lucy Hardy, a research fellow at the University of Auckland, about research showing global vaping companies are using tactics to target young people. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to the professor in the Faculty of Science at the University of Auckland, Rochelle Constantine, about what the new Hauraki Gulf Protections Act means for our larger wildlife. I also spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, Deborah Walker-Morrison, about the ongoing political crisis in France and what the instability means for President Emmanuel Macron and his party going forward.
Hey, aho whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e ahe in the koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrerano. Hei a pakihiri rokiroki mā rongi te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government has recently announced that 18 to 19-year-olds whose parents earn $65,528 annually will no longer be eligible for job seeker support. The government estimates that 4,300 young people would become ineligible under this new policy. Prime Minister Christopher Luxon says these changes to job seeker support eligibility are tough love, and that he did not want the government to send a message to young people that 18 to 19-year-olds could just drift into welfare and that's it. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about this topic. We also discussed the government saying they would amend the Policing Act to guarantee police have the power to collect intelligence through the means of photographing and videoing potential perpetrators. But first, we discussed the changes to the job seeker benefit. In Budget 2025, a move like this was originally set to come into effect by July 2027. However, this has been brought forward to November next year. Why is this?
Quite simply because officials, when pushed, have found a way to bring it forward by a year. And this government thinks it's really important that we send the right signals, because for too long, the welfare system has paid young people to sit at home instead of getting into work. That's bad for taxpayers. It's actually worse for the teenagers themselves. It's bad for taxpayers because taxpayers should go to work knowing they're funding important government services and not paying some teenager next door to sleep their future away. So it's important to bring it forward, and we just want to make sure that we are sending the right signals to people thinking about their futures.
There are concerns that this policy will also affect young people who have had to stop work or reduce their hours over health conditions and temporary disabilities. With these changes to job seeker eligibility, young people will be tested on obviously how much their parents are earning, but also things such as a parent support gap test showing that young people can receive support from their parents. With those who have had to take some leave for health reasons, will there also be a sort of eligibility test here as well, or would this be a move the government would consider?
Well, if people are on a benefit for health reasons or need to seek help for health reasons, that's quite a separate matter. This is about making sure that for people who are not in work, who are not in training, who are aged 18 to 19 and who are currently on the job seeker benefit or may think they're eligible for it next year, they won't be if their parents earn more than 65 grand a year. It's quite simple. Do not leave school, do not leave training, do not leave your job with the expectation that you're going to get a benefit. That is not our future.
The Council of Trade Unions and even the Taxpayers Union have expressed concerns that parents might reduce their hours so that the family as a whole could receive job seeker support. With the design of this policy, families earning even a dollar over the $65,528 threshold will lose out on roughly $14,000 after tax. Has the government accounted for this sort of concern?
Certainly have. I think most parents will want their kids to stand on their own two feet and, you know, faced with the choice between earning less themselves, you know, earning less as a household, or encouraging their teenagers to get out there and work or go into study, most parents will tell their kids to pull their finger out and step up. This is about setting expectations that adulthood means taking responsibility, not living a life of dependency. This is a really important reset. It's been a very long time since this type of message was delivered to families and young people who are not achieving their potential and not even trying. And you know, most New Zealanders, most taxpayers applaud this move.
Unemployment is rising in the country with 5.1% of New Zealanders unemployed. According to opposition leader Chris Hipkins, there are 36,000 less jobs compared to when Prime Minister Christopher Luxon first took office. We're seeing large numbers of Kiwis move overseas, with 70,000 leaving the country in the year to March 2025. What are the government doing to entice young New Zealanders, specifically those who are 18 to 19 years old, to stay in the country when finding a job in this current climate is so difficult for them?
This is not new. I mean, when I left school and was deciding whether to go to uni or to get a job, hundreds of thousands of people had been made unemployed in the recession following the 1987 stock market crash. But what that means is that you can't be fussy. Your first job might not be your dream job, but you need to take a start. You need to get moving. And so once you've built up some experience, some demonstrated reliability in the workforce and a good attitude, you're going to be in a far better position to move into something that you really want to do, whether that's work or training or some type of career that takes a bit longer to get off the ground. And if you can't find the job you want straight away, there are other ways to make yourself more hireable. Like get a trade, you know, join the Defence Force. The Defence Force is crying out for personnel. You know, they'll train you, they'll house you, they'll feed you. Study something practical. There's countless ways to build a future. We think that's important. That's the message the government is sending. That's the transformation that we're seeking when it comes to young people, you know, who are not in work or training. And, you know, like I said, most New Zealanders, most taxpayers are behind us. They want these young people to succeed. They want them in the workforce. There are jobs out there. We know that because New Zealand still has very high levels of immigration, immigrants coming to fill jobs in New Zealand. While teenagers sit on the couch, that's not right. And that's why we're changing these rules.
Are young people being fussy, though? There were 25,000 people who applied for 500 jobs at the IKEA that are set to open up at the end of this year. 218 young people, or just people in general, applied to a minimum wage role at a juice bar in Wellington. What is the government doing now to ensure that there are jobs just in general for young people to have?
Well, it's not the government's role to provide jobs. It's an employer's role. What government's job is to make sure that the settings for the economy are right, and we are cutting wasteful spending in government. We are reducing inflation, which is leading to a reduction in interest rates, which means that businesses can afford to borrow, to buy new plant and equipment, to open a new store or branch. We're focusing on the structural reforms to the economy, and the work that I'm doing in the resource management space, infrastructure funding and financing, we're making sure the planning system is enabling so that projects can get off the ground much faster, so they can hire workers to build roads, build schools, build hospitals. All of these things are happening in the background. But at the end of the day, you know, if teenagers, 18 and 19 year olds, not in work, not in training, are applying for jobs, I absolutely applaud them. But like I said, you know, when it's tough out there, you can't be fussy. You're just going to have to find something that gets a foot in the door. That's what I did. that's what most people do.
Moving on to our next topic, the government says the Policing Act is set to be amended to give police officers back powers to collect intelligence in public. Police Minister Mark Mitchell says officers have been left uncertain about taking people's photos and videos in public spaces. Why is there this level or sort of uncertainty that police officers are facing in this situation?
Well, in a recent court case, a judge determined that photos taken by the police for one reason could not be used as part of a prosecution for another serious crime. And so what the government is doing is clarifying when it is appropriate for evidence that the police collect in one circumstance to be applied to another circumstance. That's really important because we do have serious organised crime in New Zealand, organisations that are very sophisticated and have the same type of communications and intelligence capability as small countries. We need to be able to carry out surveillance on them to identify who these people are or what their patterns are and make sure that when it comes time to seeking a conviction, that police are not undermined by discrepancies in how they might use photo and video evidence. So this is not a radical change, it's simply clarifying how this evidence might be used in any potential case.
Opponents or critics of this amendment say this may result in the country becoming a surveillance state. What do you make of this sort of accusation?
That is absolutely incorrect. The ACT Party is going to monitor this as this legislation passes through the House. We will not accept a general ability for the police just to park up and surveil. There has to be a demonstrated need for this power. But it's also important to note that these changes actually restore the police's ability to detect and prevent crime and support prosecution so that vital information can be lawfully collected and retained for lawful purposes. It's not about general surveillance. It's about being able, as I said, photographs, video taken for one purpose, surveilling an individual when it turns out that, actually that individual's involved in organised crime or organising, terrorist activity, that the information collected for one lawful purpose can be used for another lawful purpose, simply clarifying the law.
Specifically to that point, I guess, what sort of amendments would the ACT Party then want for this Act to ensure that these sort of concerns that New Zealand might become a sort of surveillance state, what would the ACT Party propose so that New Zealanders don't have this sort of fear?
Well, the ACT Party believes in upholding civil liberties. And so when the legislation is introduced to the House, our representative on the Select Committee, and of course our caucus will be scrutinising that legislation. Cabinet has taken policy decisions, but the legislation's not in the House yet. So I couldn't say what amendments might be proposed. But again, ACT is a party of free thinkers, free speakers, and we believe in upholding civil liberties. You can guarantee we'll be laser focused on that as this legislation goes through the House.
That was the ACT Party Simon Court on the changes to job seeker support for 18 to 19 year olds and the amendments to the Policing Act.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, how do you improve a piece of shit?
The Wire.
Following my chat with Simon, I spoke more about the amendments to the Policing Act with Gahan Gunasekara, the convener of the surveillance group within the Privacy Foundation and an associate commercial law professor at the University of Auckland, about concerns these changes will create a surveillance state. Here is that chat. What is the Policing Act and what amendments are the government making?
Well, that's a good question. From the announcements I've seen, there have been one or two hints as to what the government is aiming to do, but the detail is yet to emerge. So one common ground that I would have with many of the people on both sides of this debate is I see the Police Association chairperson has said that we need better rules for what the police can and can't do. And I would agree with that statement. I would think that, if there's a lack of clarity, I think there could be better rules as to what the police can do with taking pictures in public. That said, I disagree with the minister's statement of giving police back powers that they used to have, because the Policing Act has been understood to have certain limitations, and now it appears the government wants to take those limitations away. So whether that leads to carte blanche photographing of images in public, that would be a concern.
And what happens with these videos and images police are taking? Are they deleted after legal proceedings, or what happens with them essentially?
Yeah, well, that's a $64 million question, and I think that really is the issue. Nobody has a problem with police monitoring the public, perhaps taking photos, in, you know, where there's an imminent risk of there being some public disturbance or something, to identify who is there and who might be causing it. But if there's no disturbance and the protest disperses, or if there's no crime committed, then there's no real reason to hang on to those pictures. So, and I would draw your listeners' attention to a very important report that was, I think, a few years ago, 2022. There was an investigation into police photography of rangatahi, so especially Māori youth, and there were thousands and thousands of images of people who were mainly minors, teenagers and minors, and perhaps slightly older individuals, but still they were rangatahi, and these were collected on police officers' personal phones often, and there were thousands of images, and they were asked to basically catalogue them and then delete them. So the investigation by the Privacy Commissioner and the Independent Police Complaints Authority, it was a joint report, it was very strong that those images were unlawfully collected, and there was no purpose beyond perhaps intimidating those individuals, or it was just some kind of photography which was an exercise of police power, where individuals really didn't feel free to stop police doing that, because these children, you know, are not really, they're quite vulnerable. And those images were asked to be deleted, and the police have had trouble deleting the images, because one of the issues is the police didn't know how many images they had, on which devices they were held, and that's part of the problem. So I would think that is a concern, and remember, people's images of their faces, different from other types of personal information. You can't basically order a new face. You can't change your face. Your face is you, and therefore it's particularly sensitive. And that I think, is the concern that we need to be aware of.
You mentioned that study and how it had been found by the Independent Police Conduct Authority and Privacy Commission back in 2022 that this was sort of disproportionately affecting Māori and rangatahi in general. With these amendments, would this sort of exacerbate this even more?
Well, that's an obvious concern. The minister's statements suggest that the government is now walking back from the promises they made at the time to comply with those, with the recommendations of that report. So at the time, the government committed to, and the police publicly committed to, actually complying with the terms of that report. But the minister's statements now suggest that maybe they're trying to somehow turn the clock back and legitimize that type of collection in future. It may not be the case. I don't know. The minister's statements certainly aren't that specific that we can say that that's what the minister wants to do. But if that is the case, then I would be quite concerned, because those vulnerable groups would again be quite concerned. And in overseas studies have shown that this kind of behavior leads to profiling of individuals. It leads to the targeting of certain ethnic groups and socioeconomic groups. And the whole point of retaining these images is the kind of premise that these people are inherently suspicious because of who they are and may commit crimes in future. And that, I would ask you listeners to consider, is very much the premise of the old sci-fi movie Minority Report, starring Tom Cruise. And if you remember, the premise of that film was to predict who would commit a crime and jump in before they even commit a crime. But that's really stigmatizing people to say that you know, somebody is predisposed to commit a crime. And I think as a society, we need to be careful to avoid that.
The police association, who are in support of these amendments, say that recent cases have left officers confused on when they should not take photos and videos. Why are we seeing this, as I guess the police association believes, the sort of lack of clarity, and will these amendments
please address these concerns?
I suspect the reference there is to the recent Tamiefuna case, which many people may not have heard of, but it was a decision of the Supreme Court. So that's our highest court. So there's no further appeal from that court. And it was a majority judgment, but even some of the dissenting judges in that agreed with the ruling of the majority that what had happened there was not really permissible. It was unlawful. So just to give a quick snapshot of the case, an individual was photographed at a random traffic stop, and they weren't the one targeted. It was a driver of the car who was unlicensed. So but their photo was taken just as being a passenger in the car, just because they perhaps looked suspicious or something like that. You know, there were circumstances around it. The police were suspicious. So then the police entered that photograph into their database. And by complete coincidence, not too long after that, they were able to use that photo to convict that individual of an unrelated crime. It wasn't a traffic-related crime. It was a burglary. And they were able to show that that same person was the one who committed it. Now, it was just luck that they had that photo in their database. So leaving aside the facts of the case and whether that was justice was served or not in that specific case, I think we need to move away to the principle of the case. So the principle of the case would be to say that police can take pictures of anyone they think is suspicious and keep them potentially for unlimited periods of time. And that's, I think, the concern. There already is power for police to take pictures of people in connection with an investigation, in connection with when they're charging someone. If they charge someone and then the prosecution is not pursued, then under the Policing Act currently, the images have to be deleted. So if the images are going to be retained, then I think there would have to be some clarity around for how long do individuals have access to those images to see if they're still held, because the Privacy Act, don't forget, gives people access to their personal information, and images are personal information. That's beyond question. So there's a lot of issues here. And in the Tamiefuna case, there were clear breaches of the Privacy Act because the individual wasn't told why the images were held. He wasn't told, you know, we suspect you might be doing X, Y, Z, or we suspect, or we are investigating criminal activity in relation to this type of matter, and that's why we're taking the picture. He wasn't given any information at all. So the Privacy Act wasn't complied with. The purposes were not specified. He wasn't told how long the images would be held. So these are the kinds of questions. If they're going to clarify the rules, then I would like to see those rules clarified. I'm not against there being rules for how police collect information. I think that would be a good thing, and I have some sympathy with the police who might be, you know, struggling to interpret the rules. So I think it would be a good thing to have some rules, but I think I would be very much opposed to any carte blanche discretion for the police to decide how long they're going to retain the images and whose images they can take. I think that would be a move towards a surveillance state.
That was the Privacy Foundation's Gahan Gunasekara on the concerns regarding the amendments to the Policing Act.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
95 BFM presents The Saints, 73-78, making their New Zealand debut at the Power Station, Friday, October 31. Get ready to have your senses pummeled by punk pioneers Ed Cooper, Ivor Hay, Mick Harvey, Mark Arm and Peter Oxley. A once-in-a-lifetime gig. It's The Saints, 73-78, live at the Power Station, Friday, October 31. Tickets available now from plusone.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Auraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Whoa, I've never seen so many colours come out of someone's mouth before.
There's more where that came from.
The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra is back. And if you want to see all the colours of the rainbow in one room erupting in wondrous sonic performance, then tune into 95 BFM Breakfast all week, because we've got tickets to give away to the opening night.
The Exploding Rainbow Songbook Volume 4, November 4th, 5th and 6th at Whakamana Cannabis Museum. Tickets available from Mushtix.
Audio. Culture. tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Wallau Radio. 2 hours of music from Southeast Asia and its diaspora. Complete with spicy takes, close inspections, interviews, and everything in between. Hey.
She wanna man a slide, that's why she got that...
Wallau Radio, Monday nights, 11pm till 1am. Brought to you by your hosts, Otto and JC. Only on 95BFM.
Wallawe!
I love to run from my problems. Take a little walk, pockets full of our lost dollars. Going down to the liquor store, you calling me. Where you at? I hit it all after all I did, and you still forget what I shouldn't be forgiven for. What's a girl like you?
That was Girl Like You by Tom Scott. Welcome back, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
It upsets me so much that there's still people that we need to convince this is a real fucking thing. Real friggin' thing.
The Wire. Last week, the government passed a new Hauraki Gulf Marine Protection Act. The act includes a new organisation of marine protected areas and new rules for fishing in the hopes that they will address environmental issues in the Gulf. Concerns, however, remain over the well-being of marine life, both now and going forward, and particularly that of large marine life like whales and dolphins. I spoke to Professor of Marine Ecology and Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, Rochelle Constantine, about the welfare of these larger marine animals, how this bill will help them, and what work there remains to be done. To start with, looking to the new Act itself, what are the supposed impacts for biodiversity in the Gulf?
The fact that we've moved from 0.3% protection to 6% is great news. This has been a long conversation amongst all different people who value the Gulf, and we're really happy to see this announced. It's now sort of the beginning where we can measure and see actually what the effects are. So my particular area of interest is the really large animals, the ones that people ooh and ah about, in particular whales and dolphins, but also seabirds, sharks, the rays that we see increasing number of manta rays. So these spaces where we have protection, means that when there's no fishing, we know that these ecosystems will recover if we're not removing from them. And this is, you know, recreational and commercial fisheries have quite a big impact in fish removal in the Gulf. The more fish means the more spawning, the more baby fish, and then there's a downstream effect that goes beyond the boundaries of these protected areas. When you're a big animal, like a shark or a dolphin, those fish are food and are really important. So we're expecting that these protected areas will, at least in some ways, be a source of food, of prey. And if it benefits the big animals, we know that the smaller animals are doing well as well.
And with regards to larger animals in sea life, like whales and rays, etc., what is the current state of these populations in the Hauraki Gulf and New Zealand's wider waters?
In the Hauraki Gulf, we're really fortunate. Te Kapo Moana, the sort of inner part of the Gulf, and Te Moananui Atoi, which is the outer part of the Gulf, both of those areas are incredibly rich in productivity. So the area has been recognised internationally as an important marine mammal area and also an important shark and ray area, which is a global designation. I think most people who live on the edge of it don't realise what such a special place it is. Here in the Hauraki Gulf, we have four main species of whale or dolphin that are here year-round. Brooders whales are a 15-metre long whale. They're nationally critical, so they have the same endangered species status as kakapo, as our most endangered animals. And so their use of the Hauraki Gulf year-round is very interesting. The productivity, the amount of food, they mostly eat zooplankton, but also those little small schooling fishes. People often call them bait fish, the pilchard, soury, things like that. But those are very important food for these whales. So we have those, which is fortunate. It's only one of three populations in the world so close to coast. We also have killer whales, which pass through, so they're roaming quite widely around Aotearoa, but they also are critically endangered. We have bottlenose dolphins that are the big grey ones, about 3 metres. You often find them mooching around all the bays and thrilling people when they're at anchor, catching a fish or having a snorkel. And those bottlenose dolphins are also recognised as threatened. And then we have, of course, the common dolphins, which are the beautiful they're about 2 metres hourglass pattern on their side. And so those dolphins are very ubiquitous throughout the Gulf. And you'll often see them in the outer waters in big workups. So you'll see gannets diving, common dolphins, occasionally a whale going through, and then many, many different species of seabird. And all of those animals, the seabirds, the sharks, the whales, the dolphins, in those big workups are part of a really important community. And they look at each other and learn off each other. So having a thriving Gulf is really good for supporting all of those cetaceans that I talked about, either those in workups or those mooching around the bays or picking up stingrays or whatever they may be feeding on. And basically, you know, as I tell people, if the big things are looking good, that means that the little things are okay and the health of the Gulf is okay. And so this protection means that we're moving towards that, you know, towards better protection and ultimately protection for everything to thrive, including us. You know, this is not about other animals and then us. I think we need to get closer to acknowledging our role as humans within this ecosystem function and so that we can have fish into the future, because as it's going at the moment, the Gulf is very degraded and, you know, we won't have those communities of seabirds and sharks and everything. And we also won't be able to catch a fish, which is the stories that people have.
And with that said, what sort of concerns remain for these populations in the Hauraki Gulf, both that are tackled by this new act or that are left unaddressed?
I guess one of the big challenges for us is for a lot of the animals that we have here, they're really mobile. So like the sharks aren't here all the time. Like those big oceanic sharks come in the sort of mid-later summer months. The manta rays arrive in the summer, the false killer whales, which are this big black, about 7 metre long animal, they come down in the summer months. So we kind of, and a lot of the seabirds are migratory, right? So we have these big patterns of movement, and something about, for people to really note about the big animals is they are really good indicators of what's going on. So we look after them for a little amount of time, right? They're here in these waters for a short amount of time, and then they move somewhere else, either up into the Pacific or offshore, wherever they may go. So one of the things to think about in that protection sense is this protection that we've put in place helps the system and it helps us take our foot off. This is something we can do immediately by minimizing or at least reducing our fisheries footprint, remembering that 94% of the Gulf you can still fish in, right? So it's only 6% you can't. But in that sense, that small amount of protection is a movement in the right direction that will protect the smaller things and then the larger things, but also those things that live here, as well as those animals that are only here for a short period of their life. And so protection overall is a great idea in so many ways. We actually have to give up so very little for this protection.
With this new act and these protections, in the face of climate change, how can we kind of expect these populations to benefit, or is there going to be a little bit of a touch-and-go kind of crisis, I guess?
That's a really good question. Climate change, it's not the elephant in the front room. It's the elephant walking through your house all the time. You cannot ignore it. And so this particular piece of legislation doesn't deal with climate change. It's about marine protection. So the one thing we all know and is very clear, climate change is happening. We are seeing the effects of it now. Those beautiful, long, warm summer waters that we experience, those are a disaster in the ocean. They, for seabirds, we often get starving seabirds because the prey that they're eating, the little zooplankton, the little animal planktons, it's too warm at the surface, so they move down into the water column and the seabirds can't get down to the food. We know for a fact, we've already shown that in warm years, the cetaceans move out further. So the brooders whales and the common dolphins in particular will move further out in the Gulf because their prey moves out. And for the brooders whales, that potentially puts them in, at risk of ship strike in non-protected waters, which has been a great conservation win we've had here in the Gulf. But that whole shift in the food chain, the marine food chain here in the Gulf, we are seeing that. We see that now. And protection, these marine protected areas can't resolve that. I think that's a bigger conversation we need every day to be acting to mitigate climate change impacts. But the thing that we can do immediately here and now is to think about what we're removing from the Gulf. Think about not, disturbing the seabed. Think about those small actions that we can do, thinking about what runs off from land into the sea.
And with all that said, what do you want to see from the government going forward in regards to protection and other sort of ocean-based policy?
The most important thing we can do is make sure that people embrace this opportunity and see the benefit of this protection. So we need to enforce it. There's no point having laws unless you're going to enforce them. So that is very important. We also need to understand how this is actually weather and how this is making a difference. We know that it will be making a difference, but we do need to measure that through different knowledge systems, Maturanga Māori, from research, from communities engaging, narratives of people. There's many different layers through which we can see this. So we need to invest in monitoring, we invest in enforcement, but we also need to really take seriously the 30 by 30 initiative. 30% of our waters protected by 2030 is a global initiative. This is a small step in the right direction, but we still have some way to go. I think most importantly, the government has a really critical role in stopping this conflict. It's like pro-fishing, anti-fishing, or, pro-development, anti-development. We actually need to all come together for the ocean. 94% of this country is ocean. There's 14 times more ocean than land that makes up Aotearoa New Zealand. So we need to take that seriously. More than every second breath you take is from because of the ocean. And people, we just kind of take it for granted. So the government needs to play a really big role in us embracing our ocean and looking after it better than we have been. And this protection is a step in the right direction.
That was the University of Auckland's Rochelle Constantine on the well-being of cetaceans and large marine animals under the new Hauraki Gulf Marine Protection Act.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
Hawaii.
Despite the government imposing regulations that restrict the advertisement of vaping, international campaigns are still reaching young New Zealanders through influencer marketing and sponsorship of popular overseas sporting events. In a recently published paper, University of Auckland School of Population Health Research Fellow Dr. Lucy Hardy examined how e-cigarette companies can target young New Zealanders through social media marketing and legal loopholes. 95BFM intern Zay Noor spoke with Hardy about this research and her concerns about the harm these campaigns can cause.
Your recent research has looked at how vape brands are using social media to promote themselves to young people, often bypassing existing laws and regulations put in place by governments and social media sites. What regulations are in place in Aotearoa, and how are vape companies bypassing these regulations in promoting to young people?
So in New Zealand, vape companies can't use sponsorship and they can't use social media. What we're seeing is in the global context, brands that sit outside of New Zealand can use these strategies, and then they're seen by New Zealand young people instantaneously. There's no borders and no age restrictions on that kind of content. So for example, in this recent study that we did, we looked at the vape brand owned by British American Tobacco, which is a huge tobacco company that operates globally, and on their account they're using sponsorship really heavily. So they're sponsoring big brands or events like Formula One sponsorship, but they're also using people like DJs or social media influencers, and they've all already got a huge following, and then they're reposting their content. So for example, Views, the brand, the e-cigarette brand or the vape brand, can then share the content with their agreed partners, accessing their audience. So if the influencer has 500,000 followers, that's an instant way to access that audience.
So you mentioned the way that social media and influencers are used to promote these products. In the advertising, are these influencers disclosing the potential harms of vaping?
No, I mean, there's a sort of very small line of text that says nicotine is addictive, but other than that, in most cases they weren't even disclosing that it's a paid partnership. So usually on Instagram you have to have a hashtag ad or you have to use this paid partnership button, but in our study we just found that that wasn't being used, but clearly it was a influencer setup.
And do these social media sites have regulations around non-disclosed advertising?
They do, but it's such a murky environment, and it's intentionally so because these huge social media platforms make a lot of money out of pushing this kind of glamorous lifestyle marketing that's really appealing to young people. So the policies are actually really difficult to enforce, and there's very limited resources, if any, put into actually enforcing them. What happens normally in this case, you know, researcher or someone in the community might notice it, document it, and then make a complaint. Usually the social media platform doesn't uphold that complaint. There are other avenues that you can take as well, like your local advertising standards authority, but it is really difficult to get any progress in that space.
Another marketing campaign you mentioned is how Views sponsors the Formula One team McLaren. Why do you think they chose this avenue for promotion? Why not other sporting competitions?
I think traditionally Big Tobacco has had a really strong relationship with Formula One. Formula One, I don't know if you know Drive to Survive, but it's a series on Netflix. It has a huge viewership, and all the races also have a huge viewership. So when you put your branding on the car and then it's viewed by television or the races are watched, the social media platforms are followed, you accessing a huge market, and that'll be the primary reason for them to sponsor that in particular. But they also sponsor other things, like for instance Tomorrowland Festival, which is a huge festival in Europe. You know, I'm a mother, my kids talk about that festival even though they've never been to it and they probably will never go to it. It's just a space that young people aspire to be at, and the industry knows that, and that's why they target those events.
As the popularity of vaping has increased in the past decade, what changes have we seen in the way companies advertise their products?
Well, they sort of, I mean, originally in New Zealand, we didn't have any restrictions on vaping, vape marketing for about 2 years. So in that space, it was really interesting because we could see exactly what they'd do if they weren't restricted at all. So they used things like cartoon marketing and social media marketing and all the sponsorship that we've talked about. And as there have become more and more restrictions, they find other workarounds to continue marketing to young people. So in New Zealand, recently, we identified one vape company that continued to sponsor Rhythm and Vines and other festivals by using their recycling wing of their company, because the retailer or the brand can't actually sponsor it, but they could find this workaround using the recycling arm of the company. And what that does is just continue the brand and the association with vaping can still be, you know, present in that space where young people are. And so there's lots of clever workarounds that they use to continue marketing to young people.
In your study, you mentioned the company's views and Vapo. Are there more companies also using similar marketing techniques?
Yeah, I mean, those are just two examples of the companies that we've looked at, but there are lots of other companies that operate in the same way. It's a very similar strategy to what we've seen with Big Tobacco in the past, same addictive substance and nicotine, and they know that those strategies work, so we see it across the board.
And what should be done to better regulate these campaigns to combat undisclosed advertising?
Well, I think that's a really big issue that we kind of need to approach from with a global cooperation, because these companies are, the social media companies are, you know, are operating all over the world in very instant ways. So there could be some kind of treaty or agreement about what kinds of products and what kinds of brands can be allowed to use those platforms. I'd love to see things like vaping and alcohol being banned from that type of space, because it's just too difficult to control who's seeing them and how they're making their decisions about their behaviours and based on the influence of these big companies. Other things that we could do sort of more readily in New Zealand is just really pull back on what companies are allowed to do. So, for instance, in New Zealand, they can choose up to 1,500 combinations of flavours. Most of them are sweet and fruity. That could be something that could be restricted so that we reduce the appeal of some of those products. You could also put them in plain packaging. You know, often you see them in bright colours, fruity flavours. They're really attractive products. So there's a sort of range of things we can do, ones in New Zealand, but also things that need global action. Vaping is one thing, but these companies are also constantly looking to introduce other products as well. So there's these oral nicotine pouches, which are also really popular with young people. And then, so it just, these companies now have a sort of suite of options of nicotine products that young people can use. So for example, if you're in the classroom, you could use the oral nicotine pouch. And then if you're out with your friends, you could be vaping. And then on the weekends, it's smoking. And so I think they all work together to sort of reinforce this nicotine use. And so we really need to try and capture or front foot anything else that comes into the market as well, making sure that all nicotine products are covered to safeguard young people from this intense marketing that they experience.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Lucy Hardy on her research about how vaping companies are using influencers and sports sponsorships to push vaping onto young people. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was Asarai by Phoebe Rings.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Last week, French Prime Minister and President Macron appointee Sébastien Lecornu resigned from his post after his hours-old government collapsed. By the end of the week, Lecornu was reappointed as Prime Minister by Macron. At the time of his first appointment, Lecornu was already the fifth French Prime Minister in 2 years. These events are the latest occurrences in the recent political instability in France that was further stoked by Macron's dissolution of government and the ensuing parliamentary elections that took place last year in a failed bid to secure the government. Instead, the government now sees itself split evenly between multiple blocs, with Macron desperately trying to maintain control. I spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, Deborah Walker-Morrison, about these moves, France's instability, and what this means for the future of France's government and the popularity of the far right. To start simply, how did we get here? Why has Macron's term been so unstable?
How long have we got? I think in your summary, you pinpointed what most, pretty much every political commentator has been saying in France, and that is that this crisis situation, which is absolutely not solved, it's ongoing, was caused by Macron taking the gamble to dissolve Parliament after the European elections last year, when he was alarmed by the score of the far right, the Rassemblement National, National Rally. But he considered that they would never do as well in French parliamentary elections as what they did in the European elections. And I think he thought that the French would be alarmed by that score and would rally to the centre and the centre-right. That didn't happen. The opposite happened. And since then, there is no majority in the French parliament. And in fact, there are three blocs now. In fact, some people would say five, because in the last week, the right, the main right-wing party, which has been part of these governments, Les Républicains, has splintered, with the leader of that party basically signalling that he no longer supports Macron. They had a meeting on the weekend where they instructed their MPs not to join this new government that was just announced yesterday. Six of their members decided to join it, and they have been excluded from the party. And it seems unlikely that this government will last out the year. They've immediately been threatened with a no-confidence vote by the far left, La France Insoumise, by the far right, Le Rassemblement National, and they will, looks like they will be censored by also the socialists if they do not agree to suspend the pension reform, which is the big issue at the moment.
So far, how have we seen the Macron government deal with the instability and lack of plurality in terms of both policy and these consequent ministerial appointments?
They have sought to keep hold of power. What would typically have happened after those parliamentary elections last year would be that typically the president who gets to appoint the prime minister, right, would appoint a prime minister from the biggest group in parliament. The biggest group after those elections was the New Popular Front, the Nouveau Front Populaire, so a left-wing group, but which included the far left. And Macron refused to do that, and he has successively appointed prime ministers who come from the centre-right, from his own group. And the most recent one, Sébastien Lecornu, is the closest to him personally. So he has refused to give power to the group, the left, which won the most votes in the parliamentary elections. I mean, many people were thinking at the end of last week, maybe he's going to finally understand that he needs to change, you know, he needs to change his stance. He's actually doubled down.
And with regards to the French left who received the highest share of votes in the 2024 election, what can we expect in terms of their demands and their relationship with Macron, particularly in the coming weeks?
They are now, they've kind of split into the Socialists, the Greens, and the French Communist Party, which are more, you would say, social democrat. They are on most, in the big issues, they have a different position to La France Insoumise, which we would say is far left and much more hardline. So the Socialist Party would be the most likely to form any kind of agreement with Macron. They said, we're ready to be in government. Macron said no. And so their position now, and they have announced this publicly, the Socialist Party, and I think the Greens and the Communist Party will probably follow them, is that if there is not an immediate suspension of the pension reform, which is the big issue, one of the big issues, if there's not an immediate suspension of the pension reform until after the next presidential elections in 27, they will vote no confidence. And the far left and the far right have already said that they're going to do that. The big threat right now for the 65% of French people who did not vote for the far right and who are not favourable to the far right, they have, you know, they have around 35% public opinion, which is frightening. So the biggest threat right now is the threat of the far right. But there is not, to date, in French politics, a political figure with anywhere near the popularity of Marine Le Pen and her right-hand man, Jordan Bardella. If there were to be a dissolution of parliament, new parliamentary elections, and or presidential elections, the most likely outcome could be the absolute victory of the far right.
And with that in mind, what do you want to see from Macron in regards to avoiding this far right victory and maybe working with some of those other parties?
Macron has kind of signaled that he's not prepared to do that. No one quite understands why, except I imagine that what he may be thinking in terms of his political legacy is that what has happened in the past will happen again, and that is that everyone who's not of the far right, if there is a presidential election, for example, everyone who's not of the far right will get together behind the candidate who comes ahead in the first round. I suspect that Macron has been thinking that he can still get a candidate who would win that first round against Marine Le Pen or her lieutenant, since she has been convicted of fraud and may not, fraud and embezzlement, and may not be able to stand, that's question mark. But if she's not there, then she has someone who would stand in her place and who's young and very popular.
That was the University of Auckland's Deborah Walker-Morrison on the current political crisis in France and what we can expect next.
That was The Wire.
Koira te ho takakato mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korido mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, the Privacy Foundation's Gihan Gunasekara, and the University of Auckland's Rochelle Constantine, Lucy Hardy, and Deborah Walker-Morrison. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.